Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Curtis in for Carrie Miller. Award-winning novelist Tim O'Brien came to fatherhood later in life. Maybe because of that, he decided when his boys were young to start writing to them. He wrote to his sons as if they were adults, sharing bits of advice, lessons he learned in wartime, and what it means to be a man in a culture of toxic masculinity. The finished result is Dad's Maybe Book, a funny, tender, and endearing collection of wisdom about the challenges and rewards of being a father to boys. O'Brien is a Minnesota native, and in October, he appeared on stage at the Parkway Theater in Minneapolis for a sold-out evening at Talking Volumes with NPR News reporter Brant Williams. They began by talking about excessive certainty and why O'Brien thinks it's important boys are told that they can say, I don't know.
Well, I'm sure it has to do with my time in Vietnam. Absolutism can kill people. The dominoes will fall. It wasn't maybe fall. They're going to fall. Ho Chi Minh and his cohorts will be scampering through the streets of Seattle. And not maybe. And American honor will be besmirched. And it's not maybe. It's that absolute declarations, and I try to talk about in the book and to my kids both, that it's not evil, it's not immoral, and it's not a crime to use the word maybe, or I think, or in my opinion, and have a little humility of heart and of mind. In my own life, I've been wrong at least as often as I've been right. And I've modified my thoughts as I've gotten older. I'm now 73, and I certainly don't look at the world the way I did when I was 33 or 13. And I think we all go through modifications and qualifications in our lives. And things I absolutely believed back when I was, 8 years old, there's a Santa Claus and Easter Bunny.
Sure.
Reality has changed for me.
How did you handle that when confronted with their points where your boys challenge you on the things that you hold to be true, that you believe in, that they throw a different angle at you? How did you handle that sort of thing? Were you? It sounds like there are a couple instances where they kind of ruffled your feathers a bit.
It did. There were a couple of times. Once I was watching television, and I got angry at something coming out of one of the channels, some political stuff, and I said to my wife, you know, I'm a failure as a writer. I thought I was writing these books, you know, making people think twice about killing other people. And I finally said, you know, the only book that would do the trick would be a book that would shoot off the nose and the ears and the lips of the person reading it, and they get a feel for how nasty war is. And my son Tad was listening in. He was then 7 years old, and he said, well, I guess you shouldn't hold that book in your lap. and it's a new, he got the point. But
smart, very smart.
There was another time I was also challenged by my other son, Timmy, who was 2 years older, when he asked me, are you a pacifist? And I said, yes. And he said, well, what if somebody breaks into my house and threatens to kill me? And what would you do? And I said, well, I'd try to talk to him. And he said, yeah, but what if he's really nasty and really mean and is going to kill me? What would you do? Would you kill him? And I said, yeah, I guess I would, or try to. And Timmy said, what kind of pacifist is that? And I said, the father kind. And that's a little bit about what I meant by qualifying things, that for everything that I can believe in, there's always some kind of exception to it. or amendment to it, I believe.
Well, there are some times to be certainty serves a purpose. I mean, you think of some of the great civil rights and human rights leaders. They were very certain, and they. I wonder how do you kind of delineate between here's the good certainty and here's the toxic certainty.
Well, there are two ways I do it. One is the common sense sort of Minnesota way, which is if the people are doing bad things, you struggle against them. That doesn't mean you have to go out and kill them. There's a difference between protests and sanctions and all the other things we can do, putting people in jail. You can do all those things. You can put them in jail for life. There are things you can do. Killing is absolute. You don't wake them up. They're dead. And you have no doubt that there are weapons of mass destruction. It's a slam dunk. That absolute, and you go kill people, and you find out afterward the reason for the killing didn't exist. There's a problem, because you can't wake up the dead people.
Right. As far as... I mean, is there ever a, can it ever be a cop-out to say you don't know something? Do you feel like there's sometimes when people just basically they don't take a stand because it's easier to say I don't know in sometimes?
I think that's true most of people, yeah. That we're busy with our lives and we don't have time to do the things we should be doing. It's part of the reason I wrote this book. To bring up some things that might engender people to think twice before sending other people's children off to kill other people. If you're for a war, go to it if you support it. What are you doing sitting in your bow tie in some television studio and in the Fox Channel? Why are you there? Go fight it, unless you think you support a war only to the extent that other people should kill and die.
Right.
And that's called hypocrisy in my book. And what I'm fighting against partly as I'm speaking is something I'm carrying in my head for the last 3 days on this book tour, is that my book has been talked about as a parenting book. But I couldn't write one because I don't know how to give advice even to myself. And it's a book more about being a father and the things you and I are talking about. What's in the book reflects our dinner conversations and the things we talk about at bedtime, that sort of thing.
Right, right. This is Talking Volumes. I'm Brant Williams, and my guest tonight is Tim O'Brien. We're at the Parkway Theater in South Minneapolis, and we're talking about his latest book, Dad's Maybe Book. And I want to ask you about, as you mentioned, this is a book about you being a dad, and we're all walking, we're exploring this with you as you are going through your ups and downs. And there's a couple things, and I don't want to give away too much in the book, but I mean, there are times when you tell stories to your kids, to the boys. Is it you made up stories every night? Is that?
Yeah, I make them up. I usually make them up about their teachers. They should respect their teachers and so on, but they're human beings. And so I get my kids laughing about them, about neighbors and so on, and a lot of them about myself. They laugh at me, the things I've done in my life that weren't so great. And I tell them a few really embarrassing true stories about myself. I had been at a very fancy cocktail party in New York, a literary one, full of all kinds of literary celebrities. And I'd put my finger or my hand in my pocket, and I cut it. I don't know how I cut it or on what I cut it, but it came out bleeding. And my agent was standing 2 feet away and said, "You should put alcohol on that." And right next to me, as close as that bottle of water there, was an open bottle of scotch. And I just, if it had been 2 feet away or 6 feet, I wouldn't have done it. I just dunked it in. And a gray-haired old lady, this is in the age of AIDS. This is not good. This
yeah.
is bad.
Yeah.
And a woman saw me do this, probably the grandmother of a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist. And she really went after me. There was this handsome movie star-looking waiter standing there, and he dunked his finger. And I'm just full. I'm just humiliated and mortified and so on. And she wouldn't stop. She blamed my blue jeans, and she blamed my hat, and she blamed me for this indiscretion. It's not the word. This is bad.
Yeah.
Well, you tell your children about this. Part of them is laughing, but part of them are looking at me in a new way. What a doofus I'd been.
I'm curious if this was because at the time when you weren't writing other books, you'd taken the time off. Was it a way to help you also kind of keep those story writing, storytelling muscles worked out while you're?
I think you're right. I think it was. I did quit. I mean, when you're spending 12, 15 hours a day at a computer every day, and then on the hours you're not doing that, you're thinking about a novel and worrying about it, and is that character coming alive, and are people going to be enjoying the plot? You can't be a good father. I couldn't have been anyway without being wholly present. So I thought, if I'm not with the kids, I mean, wholly there and not daydreaming about a book or writing it. So I quit. I said, that art's important to me, but human beings are more important, especially these two little boys. So I quit. And I'm glad I did. But you're right that eventually, when they got to be 7 or 8 years old, I began doing little three-page, four-page little love letters to them that I tuck away in a drawer, really thinking that when they're in their middle age, there'll be something left behind for them, kind of what you said in your introduction. And one day, my younger boy, Tad, saw those pages, and he asked, is this going to be a book? And until he said that, I hadn't even conceived of the idea that this would be a book. But I did say maybe. And he said, well, you have to call it what it is. You got to call it your maybe book. And at first I rejected the idea. I thought, well, that's silly. But then I began thinking about it, and my whole life in a lot of ways has been the theme of my life has been maybe-ness. In Vietnam, you take one step, maybe you'll take another. Hmm. One step, maybe another. That area I was in, Quang Nai Province, was heavily mined, and 85, 90% of our casualties came from mines. And I carried that home with me back to Minnesota, and have carried it now into my old age, where tomorrow is maybe. Maybe so, maybe not. Maybe my dreams will come true. Maybe they won't. Maybe I'll change my dreams. And I think all of us, in that sense, are writing our maybe books, kind of full of these maybe tomorrows.
Right. There's another part of the book where, and again, I don't want to give too much away for folks who are in the middle of reading or are going to be reading it. You tell a story about Timmy's first words, which... it's basically a lie, but it was meant as a well, I'll let you talk about it. I mean, how the lie that you tell, and you don't even have to say exactly what those first words are, but I'm curious about the mix between storytelling and lying, and what's the lesson
right
there?
Well, I was put in the position of having to give a lecture to aspiring writers, and at a place called Swanee. It's a writers' conference in Tennessee. And I decided that I would write a little anecdote about my kid's first words, Timmy, which were, "'Tis a tale told by an idiot." And I talked about bringing the boy to the Swanee Health facility and how a doctor examined him and said, "Well, your kid hasn't got polio and he hasn't got cancer. If it's a disease, it's a good one. It's Shakespeare." And... after this lecture, what I was trying to do was, there's a nobility and a sublimity to imagination and art and making stories up. A guy came out to me on the lawn afterward, just furious. He taught English at some prestigious university. And he said, "You lied to us." And I said, "Well, yeah, but everybody laughed." And he said, "Yeah, but that's what we made fools out of us. We were laughing at something that wasn't true." And I said, I didn't intend that. I intended just to, and he stopped me. And he snarled fabrication in words like that. And I finally got pissed off at him. And I said, well, are you a writer? And he said, yes, I'm a superb writer. And I said, do you write fiction? And he said, yeah, I write fantastically great fiction. And I'm getting angrier and angrier and angrier as this is going on. And I said, well, why don't you write a book on automotive mechanics? And he said, well, I take that as an insult. I'll be reporting you accordingly. So what began as kind of a frivolous little story, the real words that had come out of Timmy's mouth were a whole sentence. First words were, this so is mine. We called a soda a so in our house.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't have believed that either.
Right.
The real world. So what's the difference? Might as well be Shakespeare.
Well, and part of the, you know, when you're talking about is the value of fiction goes beyond. I mean, obviously there's truth in fiction, but if somebody's looking for everything to be 100% factually correct, then they're missing something, right?
Is that right? Yeah, they should be writing automotive mechanic books if they expect. Maybe it would be like going to a movie and looking at the movie and saying, that isn't true, that isn't true, that isn't true, that isn't. If you're looking for that kind of truth, you're looking in the wrong place if you're looking at art. Picasso has this great line where he says, you know, art is a lie that makes us realize truth. And that's really well said. That's a good, that's how I view it as well. And I think how most of us do, that we know when we open any novel or read a short story or see a movie, we know we're entering a world that's partly of, largely, maybe wholly of make-believe, of invention, and yet is rooted in the real world. It comes out of the real world, but imagination takes over and a story is born. And this gentleman out on the lawn that day didn't know that. That's a polite way of saying what I really want to say.
So, no, what about, I mean, so this book, you rely on a lot of your memory of these things that happen, these anecdotes. Should we expect that everything is 100% true in this book?
No. In fact, I write about that in the book. Number one, memory is faulty. Nabokov says memory speaks, but memory stutters. It speaks in ellipses. And I'm talking about yesterday. How much in anybody in this audience, and myself, and you, how much do you really remember about yesterday? Every word that came out of your mouth? No. Everything that came out of you out of the radio or the television set? No. Your conversation with the tile man, and who came first, the tile man or the plumber? You can't remember. We forget which head of cabbage should I buy at the supermarket. We erase, I think, most of our lives as we live them, and certainly I have. I'm left of my childhood and my time in Vietnam and even my time as a father. I'm left with a few little YouTube clips, maybe 5 seconds, 8 seconds long, and a whole, you know, maybe a scrapbook full of still pictures. And most everything is gone. And so I have the illusion of knowing myself. But in fact, I've obliterated from my memory most of what occurred in my life, including most of today.
As far as looking at the anecdotes that you include in the book, was there some discussion between you and your wife about which things you may or may not want to include?
There was.
What were some of those?
There's a chapter about Timmy getting cut from his basketball team in ninth grade. He had lived for basketball. He was really good at it, but not good enough. And he came home from school one day and with a broken heart. He told us what had happened, and he went to his room, shut the door, and essentially didn't open the door for 6 weeks or so. By that I mean he closed a psychological door. I'd say, how are you? And he'd say, I'm fine. And my wife and I felt so helpless. He tried so hard to be good at putting an orange ball through a basket. which is preposterously human, really is, that you try so hard at something that's not saving the world from, it's a ball in a basket. But he cared so much and had tried so hard. And one night he came to me, he was, 13 years old, I guess, and he sat on a couch with me. And for the first time in, I don't know, about 4 years, he actually held me, took me. And he said, I'm not good enough at that game. And I said, I don't think you were. And he said, but I'm not going to stop. I'm going to keep playing. I'm going to keep getting better. I'm going to try.
Well, and that brings us to a section that I'd like you to read, which is a chapter titled Pride, where you talk about an episode which and gave you that sense of dad pride.
Okay.
So why don't you go ahead and read that for us?
One constituent of a father's pride is simple astonishment. We expect to instruct our children. We are then surprised to find them instructing us. An illustration. Several years back, on his ride home from school, Timmy noticed a man crying on a sidewalk along 15th Street in downtown Austin, Texas. The man was probably homeless, though not certainly, for his appearance and carriage had nothing of the beaten-down destitution of life on the streets. His clothing seemed clean. He was close-shaven. He wore a new-looking cap with the words Vietnam Veteran imprinted on it. Timmy yelled at my wife Meredith to stop the car, but it was rush hour, and stopping wasn't possible. Timmy looked over his shoulder at the crying man as the crying man receded, and then Timmy himself was crying. He cried all the way home. He cried again at the dinner table. It was more than crying. It was unstoppable, quivering. Somebody had died wailing. He got out of his chair and lay on the floor and bawled. Early the next morning, before the sun had risen, I found my son sitting on a kitchen countertop where he had just finished packing a brown paper bag with little gifts for the crying man on 15th Street. Timmy had packed a yo-yo, a sandwich, a granola bar, a photograph of himself, some fishing line, an apple, and a copy of one of my books. For several weeks afterward, riding to school, he searched for the crying man on 15th Street. But in the end, as anyone might guess, he never again saw that man. The sandwich grew moldy, the apple rotted, the granola bar was consumed by Timmy's brother. No one in our family has forgotten this episode. Certainly Timmy hasn't. A year or so after the incident, for his English class, he began writing a poem called My 15th Street Friend, which is reprinted later in these pages. Though the poem isn't bad for a 9-year-old, its literary merits and defects are not what caused me to look at my son in a new way. Rather, I was surprised, even amazed, that he had been carrying that hurt inside him for more than a year, that he had cared enough to still care, and that I had so wildly underestimated my own child. I would have guessed he might write about Minecraft, or about basketball, or about numerous other interests that appeared to consume him day after day. Not only had he not mentioned his 15th Street friend in many months, but virtually everything in his life had seemed utterly transitory. Here, then gone. One moment he'd be clicking a Rubik's Cube. The next moment he'd be watching NBA highlights. The next moment he'd be wrestling with his brother. Until the day he began writing that poem, I'd taken it for granted that his compassion was as short-lived and perfunctory as my own. As an adult, humbled by my own failures and deficiencies, I have come to expect the worst of myself, almost never the best. And Timmy's compassion for a suffering stranger reminded me of my own pitiful mediocrity, how I donate a few bucks to the United Way, but then avoid the eyes of the homeless. I may feel saddened, but I don't cry, nor do many others, nor, I guess, do you. Now, after the passage of several years, what strikes me is the realization that an 8-year-old kid had become a better person than I am, able to feel what I do not. What had years ago been painful to me, seizing me by the throat, has now become little more than nervous embarrassment. What had once been empathy had become what Kafka calls the frozen sea of mankind's heart. If a person's humanity is measured by quality of feeling, my inner sea had frozen miles deep. This may be part of growing up or part of living in an imperfect world, but it is no less depressing and no less despicable. Timmy's poem and the incident that generated it made me want to take Kafka's axe to the frozen sea inside me. And maybe that explains, at least in part, why this maybe book is being written in the first place. I want to hammer away at the ice. I want to yell, "I love you. I love you," with every stroke on this keyboard.
That was Tim O'Brien talking with NPR News' Brant Williams at Talking Volumes. We'll return to their conversation in just a minute, but first, a break for the news with Phil Picardi. Now, back to the conversation between Minnesota author Tim O'Brien and NPR News' Brant Williams. O'Brien was on stage at the Parkway with Brant in October, part of the Talking Volumes series. We jump back into the discussion right after O'Brien said he doesn't like audiobooks because to him, reading is a singularly private, interior experience, a belief he's had since he was very young.
I had fallen in love with a book called Larry of the Little League when I was 7 or so. And I actually wrote a book, my first book when I was 9, based on it, called Timmy of the Little League. And I am not kidding. It wasn't just based on it. It was essentially just inserting the word Timmy wherever Larry... And I remember at one point that naturally the Timmy character, you know, got the game-winning hit in the Worthington Little League playoff. We came up to the Twin Cities in my book, and we beat up on Edina. We beat him like 30-0. And I scored all 30 runs.
Nice.
And at the end of this is like a 30-page. I mean, I thought it was a book. And at the end, we went to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where we just slaughtered Taiwan. And I can't remember the score, but they know 10,000-0. I was pitcher and catcher. I did it all.
You can create your own world.
And my mom, before she died, she swore she had this thing. And I was like, don't ever show it to anybody.
Do you think, as you mentioned, if somebody is reading you a story, reading you from a book, that you have this intermediary, and I know you've said in past interviews about how you feel like a good book reads, or it leaves room for the reader to bring their own experience to it.
For sure.
Is that kind of what you mean there? I mean that when you have somebody who's maybe emphasizing words here and there that maybe you wouldn't emphasize as you're reading, it's kind of pushing out your own personal experience that you're trying to bring to the book.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's partly that, and it's partly, I guess, I'm bothered by excessive explanation when the reasons for why a character is the way the character is, and you get all these reasons, bad child, it begins to sound false to me. The human being, and it's also a little bit like joining the magician backstage, where what, from the front, looking at the magician is artful and mysterious and entertaining and delightful. When too much explanation happens, it feels like you're getting, here's how the trick is explained. Here's why Madame Bovary was as she was. If Flaubert had done that to excess, I would have felt that it's not my participation. So I believe in leaving things largely as mysterious as they are in life. I don't know even why I do most of what I do. I don't know why I'm here. I could give reasons, but it wouldn't be everything. It's mysterious to me. I just talked about being a guy who likes to be alone, and here I am not alone. And I think all of us are enchanted by mystery of that. I met this interesting person, and I don't quite understand him. Or something happened in my life, and I wish I knew why Jack had said that to Jill. And I'm enchanted by history that's mysterious. The thoughts of Custer at the end of the Battle of Little Bighorn, just before he was killed, and did he recognize that he was about to receive exactly what he'd come prepared to deliver? Was he aware of the irony? What happened to Amelia Earhart? We're still enchanted by plot mysteries in history.
Right. Well, as you mentioned, and this also comes out in the book, that which I didn't know about you just from some of the past reading about you that I did to prepare for this, was you're a bit of an amateur magician yourself. You've been doing magic since you were a kid, right?
I have been, yeah.
So talk a little bit more about, that intersection between the role of the magician and the role of the writer in creating an illusion for people, and how much do you, bring as that, as that writer, you want them to see a little bit here, but not too much, and they'll find that out later. And same with the magician, there's some things you want them to see and not see. Talk a bit more.
Well, I can start by just telling you a little bit about why it enchanted me in the first place, and that kind of answers your question. I grew up in a family where my dad was a terrible alcoholic and institutionalized twice up at Wilmer. House full of tension, lots of arguments, vodka bottles hidden all over the house. I was scared of him. I idolized him and loved him deeply. Great man when he wasn't drinking, but he was drinking a lot. And magic was a way for me to escape that world. And I'd go down into the basement and had a stand-up mirror that I'd practice sleight of hand in front of and other kinds of tricks. And it was a way of getting away from some brutal realities of what was happening in that house. I carried the hobby through all the way through high school, not through college, not to Vietnam, but then took it back up again when I went to grad school. And I've been doing it ever since. My wife and I, Timmy and Tad too, and a group of maybe five or six friends put on every 2 years a two-hour magic show, dancing and music and 160 tricks happening one after the other, that because there's so many of them, they come at you, it's sort of, you don't have time in the audience to say, how is it done? You don't start thinking about the mechanical stuff because there are so many, there's no time to think about it. There's a new one happening. And this feel when you're on the stage, it was a magical, when you're doing this, even for a living room audience of 100 or so people, it feels that you're not yourself anymore. That's how I feel when I'm writing a book. I'm not myself anymore. I'm all these people inhabiting the book. And that's the great, beautiful, shining feeling I get through magic, that you've sort of left oneself and you're inhabiting all these other lives. There's also a negative feel to it, which is can be dangerous, which they're sort of, you're really in control, almost a godlike control of the characters in your book. They're doing things that you're willing through volition to have them do. And that can be dangerous. It's probably my main failure as a writer, that I'm trying to push characters in a certain direction, but sometimes they just don't want to go. And that creates bad dialogue. They're saying things that don't sound real. And I have had to learn over my 73 years that what I should have learned 50 years ago, which is to trust your own story. And trust it. If character wants to go to Fiji with Henry and Henry doesn't want to go, you trust what's going to happen. And don't try to force it in a direction. To just trust in story. It's a hard thing to do, to surrender to it, but I have managed to do it. I make myself surrender to it.
Right. This is Talking Volumes. I'm Brant Williams here at the Parkway Theater with Tim O'Brien. We're talking about his new book. And, there's something else I was curious about, like reading how you're describing how you would get up at 3 a.m. in the morning to write. Is that the way you always write? Or is this just because of when you started embarking on this particular project, you would get up early so you could have time for the boys too?
Well, it coincided with embarking on this project, but I think it mostly has to do with getting old. That old people wake up early. I sometimes get called an older father, and I keep telling people subtract the "er," and I'm not older anymore. I'm just old. I'm sometimes surprised to find myself up at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I have a ritual that I've been doing since starting this book, which is to do the dishes from the night before. And then polish the kitchen counters and clean everything up. And during these darkened hours when my kids are asleep, my wife and a lot of other people are not awake at 2 in the morning, I feel little bumblebees going through my head. Sometimes it's memory. When I was a junior in high school, I had an English teacher named Miss Wick. And she kept visiting me in these early, watch her grammar. And
wow.
She taught English with her breasts. She was like 65 years old.
Right.
And she would do Wordsworth, just bouncing it. And we were all, everybody in the class, women included, were just hypnotized by her. She was a great teacher. I mean, she was really... She was ferocious,
mm-hmm.
and but Miss Wick, after forgetting her for 50 years, if she didn't enter my thoughts, is suddenly back, and she's saying, "You write a good book and watch your sentences and your grammar. Be clear, don't be wordy." Sort of the George Orwell's advice she's given for writing well. And then there'd be a Vietnam would revisit me, and then the day of my son's birth would revisit me. And occasionally something worth using would come through these bumblebee thoughts that I could, that could be a chapter, and look into that. Usually it would come in the form of just a line that would occur to me, just to come up with a line that can lead into a story. And sometimes a decent line would come to mind as a way of an entry place into a story, and then follow the language afterward. And that's been my 2, 3, 4 a.m. life now for the last 7 years. I gave up writing for 10 years. I began seriously about 7 years ago writing this book.
Right. Is writing an easy process for you, difficult process, generally speaking,
no.
Or are some books write themselves are a little easier to write than others?
It's terribly hard. I should have been a plumber or something. That it's so hard. It's hard in different kinds of ways. The making of sentences that will satisfy me is hard. They have to feel to me somehow fresh, that I haven't uttered it before and I haven't heard it uttered to me. Haven't seen it on a television show. It's got to feel fresh in some way. If it's only a coupling of a certain adjective with a certain noun, and that gives it a freshness. But then it's got to make sense. And then it's got to have music underneath it. And it's the musicality of prose that, if it's not there, you can have a great plot and wonderful characters, but without that, that ship is going to just sink to the bottom of the sea. It's what the music of the prose what buoys it up.
Right.
And I want a Midwestern diction and that conversational as opposed to a lecturing style. Or I'll never be a Nabokovian. I'll never be an Updikean. But I will be a Tim O'Brienian.
Yeah.
Whatever that is. And that's a guy from Worthington. And who speaks the way I was spoken to by the people around me in my hometown.
Sure. Do you get inspiration from just if you're out somewhere and you hear people talking? Maybe you're overhearing. You're at a coffee shop or something like that, and you overhear a conversation. Does ever that spark an idea for dialogue in a story?
Yeah, occasionally it happens. Occasionally on an airplane, I'll hear somebody talking behind me before I got deaf. On a train ride coming from New York to Philadelphia yesterday, there was a woman sitting, there was an aisle, and I was on the aisle seat, and there was a woman next to me talking to her seatmate, another woman. And they were chatting about something to do, I couldn't hear it all, but something to do with church. And a line was uttered by the woman against the window, "I'll never go again." I didn't hear why. But wouldn't that fascinate you?
Sure, why? You'd want to know what led up to that.
I'll never go again. Now, maybe the subject had changed from church, but as a writer, I want them associated. I mean, I want the line to be about church, to discover why I wouldn't, what happened. That's an example. It's a really good example of you wouldn't steal it exactly from the real world, but you'd take something from it and run with it.
Right. As you said, you're listening for a kind of music underneath your prose, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there are examples that you can fall back on that you've read that you go, if there's a standard that you want your writing to meet, if it pops in some way that sentences that other, maybe Hemingway or somebody else had written that makes is a signal to you that maybe you've got it right.
Well, kind of, and kind of not. It's a mixture of two. Take the pronoun it. That word is that common word that we use maybe 20,000 times a day. Who knows how many, but a bunch. Is used in a Hemingway story by a character, Nick Adams, telling his girlfriend, "It's over." He doesn't utter the word our relationship or our romance. He says it's over. And it's a way that we all have in a way of substituting that pronoun when we don't want to utter the noun. To say our love is over is a lot different from saying it's over. And the word it can and probably did haunt the recipient of Nick Adams' words, that young woman, for a long time. Words catch my eye. Sometimes they're common words, sometimes they're uncommon words. We were at an outdoor modern dance thing in Texas. It happened in a ranch, in a horse paddock. And it involved these nine lovely young women and a very large horse. And It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was strangely, weirdly beautiful. And Timmy, who was maybe, I don't know, 6 years old at the time, was sitting with us, and his brother Tad was next to him. And Meredith, my wife, leaned over and said, do you understand what's going on? And Timmy said, sort of. And Meredith said, well, you see that young woman? She's a foal trying to learn to walk. And Timmy said, yeah, but what about all the other shenanigans? It was the word shenanigans that said, I've always wanted to, I mean, as soon as I heard the word, I thought, God, I got to put that in a book. And I did. I put it in this.
That's
in
a
this,
great word.
And I just put it in this talk we're having tonight. It's just a great word, especially when it's applied to modern dance.
Right. You know, as you mentioned, you wrote your first book at 9 years old. But when did you get a sense that you really could do this for a living?
I think early. I'm a stubborn human being. There's a reason I spent 12 hours in that. And I was not going to... It's a little bit like Timmy with basketball. I'm not naturally gifted at it. I'm not naturally gifted at much of anything. But I do have a quality of tenacity and stubbornness, like a mule walking up a hill. And I was determined from the time I was in... sometime after Vietnam, while I was writing my first book, that I knew it wasn't a great book. I knew it was a good book. And an honest the memoir about my time in Vietnam. And I learned a lot by writing that book. But what I really, it wasn't literary stuff I was learning. What I was learning was putting my butt down and doing it every day regularly, which I've now done for 50-some years with that 10-year gap when my children were born, that you can't write a novel or even a good short story, in my opinion, without being at it in a regular way. It's like dreaming. You wake up from a dream, and you love the dream, and you go get some orange juice out of the refrigerator, but you can't get back into it. Mm. And without that sense of regularity. And so it's more of a temperamental quality that made me think I can do this. I'm good at stubbornness. I always wished for a little more of Updike's kind of gift for speaking the way he writes. He can he used to be able to talk the way in similes, like eight of them strung together. And he was amazing. And I don't have that gift, but I had to have the gift of tenacity. And I also have a high standards as to what I think is good. Yeah. They're high standards for me. That is, they're not applicable to anybody else, but I have standards that I need to have this sense of, I haven't even thought of this before, but then a line appears. And it's just by sitting there trying other lines that are, you know, dismal until a line somehow magically appears. I think partly because I've exhausted mediocrity. There's no more left.
Well, there you go. When all those fails.
Go to your car. The engine's still warm.
That was Tim O'Brien and Brant Williams on stage at the Parkway Theater in October, part of the Talking Volumes series. I wish upon you all the gift of tenacity. I love that line. We close with the musician from that night, Molly Mayer. She's singing On Your Way Out.
On your way out, leave a message. On your way out, leave a message. On your way out.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!